On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
Well, we're recording before St. Patrick's Day, but this is airing right after St. Patrick's Day. It's a very appropriate book for us to discuss at this time because it's the story of one of the most famous descendant of Irish immigrants that was ever in America, and that is the family, President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the first Irish Catholic to be elected president of the United States. And to talk to us about his family, grandfather, great-grandmother, great-grandfather, etc., is Neil Thompson, journalist and author of five highly acclaimed books, including A Curious Man, which was a PBS American Experience documentary, Driving with the Devil, and Kickflip Boys. Former newspaper reporter, he's written for The Times, The Post, Esquire, Outside, Vanity Fair, The Journal, Oprah.com, and more, appearing on all sorts of radio and television shows. His books have been named Best of the Week, the Month, or the Year by Glamour, Amazon, O Magazine, Wall Street Journal, Outside Magazine, and other places. The book we're going to talk about today is The First Kennedys, The Humble Roots of an American Dynasty. It's from Mariner Books, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Neil, thanks so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf.
Great to be here, Doc. Thanks.
So how did you get interested in the immigrant experience? What was the first place of connection that you made with the Kennedy family?
Over time, I became more and more fascinated with sort of this humble immigrant experience of the early Kennedys. But in my very initial sort of connection to this story goes way back to 1999 when I was a newspaper reporter for the Baltimore Sun, and I was sent to Hyannisport up on Cape Cod to cover the disappearance and then subsequent death of John F. Kennedy Jr.
Right.
So I was up there at that time, part of the gangs of reporters covering the story, and as I left there, headed back south through my home state of New Jersey, and I realized that I was driving within a few miles of my own Irish immigrant grandparents. And something around then and soon after kind of clicked. I started to develop a new curiosity about my own Irish heritage alongside a renewed kind of curiosity about the Kennedys. Where did they come from? Who were the first ones to come to America? What was life like for them in a nation that aspires to be a nation of immigrants, but at times doesn't always live up to that aspiration? So it took me a number of years of fits and starts and false starts to figure out how to get into this story and who to focus on and how to find the information. And in time, I discovered the story of JFK's great-grandparents, Bridget and Patrick, which happened to be the same name as my Irish immigrant great-grandparents, Bridget and Patrick. So that's where it all started.
Okay. Well, those were very, very, very popular names for Irish families in the 19th century. One of the things that you write about in the book is the percentage of women who came to America to escape the famine who were named Bridget, the by and far the most popular name, and Patrick is probably the most popular men's name, even among Irish descendants now. My oldest son is named Sean Patrick Kirby. The Kirby family comes from County Derry, I believe, and so I, like you, am the descendant of Irish immigrants. At one point, we were the largest ethnic group in America, and when the Irish first came here, it was they were not welcome with open arms. The poet had not penned those wonderful lines that are on the base of the Statue of Liberty, and the Statue of Liberty wasn't even there when most of our ancestors came across the big pond and right, escaping the famine.
Yeah, and I found some of that to be kind of remarkable. I mean, I knew in broad strokes that the Irish weren't always welcome with open arms, you know, similar to any other immigrant group, especially the large numbers of Irish come into America after the potato famine. Mm-hmm. But I was astounded to learn some of the nuances of what the reception was like for them and how unwelcome they actually were and how you know, a political party had organized to oppose Irish immigration and to prevent Irish and Catholics from voting and from becoming naturalized citizens of America, from holding public office. I mean, over and over and over again through the 1800s, the period I write about in the book, you see this resistance to these newcomers who are coming, you know, as people said at that time and would say across future years, they're coming to take your jobs, they're coming to bring their crime, they're coming to bring their weird religion to this country. There's just so much fear and full-on hatred of these people, and I found it remarkable to learn that this family that we think of as later becoming so influential and revered and powerful, you know, they started out with nothing. They started out as the despised immigrant class of their day.
The Know Nothing Party is the one that developed, and I remember learning about them quite a while ago, but I only recently learned Samuel Morse was one of the big sponsors of the party, he of Morse code fame, and that you brought out another aspect of that I had never heard, and that is that the dots and dashes were not only called code, that they could be a way to encode things that the Irish Catholics wouldn't be able to discern.
Yeah, there was so many, you know, you saw during that period of fear. Fear of the incoming immigrants, and just misunderstandings too. You saw literally conspiracy theories floated around about what the Irish were doing here in America.
Right.
You know, the truth was they were escaping a homeland that was falling apart. They were refugees. But the fear that you got in America was, why are they coming here? What's this Catholic religion? They're coming to with their evil popery, as it was called, and
right.
They want to take over and make you know, America a Catholic country. There were just so many people freaked out.
In
a nutshell.
And sadly enough, there was a common enemy at one point, the British nation. But by the 1840s, we weren't so annoyed with England as we had been in two of the previous occasions. And so instead of that being a connection with the Irish, who had felt oppressed by the British for hundreds of years, instead, it just gave us another reason in America to go, why'd they show up? Why are they showing up now?
Right, right. We don't want you here.
Yeah, and I can remember reading, I was a little boy when John Kennedy was elected, but I can remember my parents telling me that one of the things that got spoken about often was if he was elected, he would not be beholden to the Pope. And my first thought was, why in the world would he be? But that was one of the fears. That's one reason he was really the only second serious Catholic to ever run for president, right?
Yeah, after Al Smith, right?
Yeah,
he had to go out of his way to make it clear that he wasn't beholden to the Pope in Rome, right? Like, he had to downplay his religion in order to win enough voters so they wouldn't, you know, they had those same assumptions even in his day, the fears of his religion that started when his parents first, or great-grandparents first came over.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a minute or two about the potato famine, because for those of us who are of Irish ancestry, most of us have heard the stories, and it's better known now than it was, but what happened in Ireland in the 1840s was a combination of reliance on one food crop because everything else was being sent to the people that owned the land, which were not the Irish. I think you have in here 88% of all the farmland in Ireland around this time was owned by basically mostly absentee landholders that lived in England who were English.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, it was not a free country. It was a colony of England, and the land was primarily owned by the English, primarily the ruling class in England. And so they had their vast estates, and then the poor Irish tenant farmers, you know, had an acre or two or a dozen acres here and there. But it was very much a small farming economy. And so, as you said, when the potato crop dies repeatedly year after year in the mid-1840s, the Irish could either eat the food that they were growing to pay for their rent, or find other means of sustenance and sell the food that they were growing to pay their English landlords. So, you know, the choices were harsh. You either starved or you got evicted, or in the case of the early Kennedys that we're talking about here, you escaped.
Yeah, and there were about a million people that starved, right?
Yeah, they did, and it was terrifying. I mean, you know, the English didn't help. America helped a little bit, but you know, that was complicated too. We did send some supplies and food and funding and clothes, but the English were resistant to welcome a full-on sort of rescue of that right. nation. I think they were willing to let it starve.
Yeah, there was a feeling that, well, if it starves them out, then that's one less trouble that we have. The Irish, they're always giving us trouble. So if they all die off, great.
That was the attitude.
Or move, who cares?
Right.
You know, check that off the box. Don't have to worry about that anymore. So when Bridget, when Patrick come to America, they don't know each other yet. He's leaving a family that was a little better off, but Bridget is not. And for her, like a lot of women, this was a chance to kind of redo, right? I mean, this was a reboot for their life in a sense.
Yeah, and that was really fun to explore in the book, this idea that for Irish women who, had they stayed in Ireland, with or without the famine, life wouldn't have been so great. They would have worked on either their family farm, work for their parents, or if they were lucky enough to be an older sister who got a dowry from their parents, maybe they'd find another nearby farmer son to marry and become a farm wife, you know, same life that their parents had experienced. Like, it was very, very much a peasant lifestyle and economy, and had been that way for centuries because of the oppression of the English colonizers of the country. So for Bridget, the famine, it kind of offered her an escape. She was the first to leave her family and come to America. I picture her sort of volunteering and saying, okay, I'll go to America, I'll establish a beachhead for our family, and I'll send for other family members once I get established there. And I think it says a lot about her, you know, her drive and ambition and her character that she was willing to take that risk and come to America alone.
Yeah.
And sort of try and make a life for herself, and then marries and starts a family with Patrick. And eventually it becomes the family we know, but it all really started with Bridget escaping, and she was part of this wave of mostly women who were coming to America at that time, more Irish women leaving Ireland than Irish men.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Neil Thompson, who is the author of The First Kennedys, The Humble Roots of an American Dynasty. It's from Mariner Books, which is an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers, and available in bookstores and everywhere right now. The tragedies that both of them endured, we have them getting married. They're married for not all that long. Patrick is a guy who had learned how to be a cooper back home, how to build barrels. And interestingly enough, the Irish, it seems like for most of the rest of the 19th century, one of the really great jobs you could have is either making alcoholic beverages or selling alcoholic beverages. And these were positions that were open to the Irish. They could make their own, sort of make their own way with it and build their own life based on those two trades.
Yeah, it's interesting to track the beginnings of the Kennedy family's ascent alongside their involvement in the liquor trades. And I think you're right. They found whatever job they could, because there weren't many that were available to them, and most of those that were available were on the low rungs of the economic ladder. You know, the men worked in ditches and the women worked as maids. But in the Kennedy family, you see Patrick making whiskey barrels and beer barrels. He has a skill that gives him a little bit of an advantage over other Irish immigrants at that time. And then later you see Bridget, his wife, after Patrick has died, opening her own grocery store where she sold liquor on the side, like many of these small Irish groggeries, as they were called, did. And then her son, PJ, gets involved in the saloon business. And then many years later, his son, Joe, gets involved in importing liquors to America. So, you know, the whole sort of establishment of the family wealth and power is tied to the selling of liquor in America.
That's kind of interesting. And that puts them on the odds with different groups, the abolitionists. And apparently toward the end of the 19th century, Republicans were trending toward prohibition, just as they had once trended toward abolition. That put them at odds with the Irish Catholics, who were saying, this is the only way we have to survive here and thrive in any way. and even the little stores like Bridget's depended on selling alcoholic beverages as well. Now she learns, she goes to work for Jordan Marsh, who is very encouraging to his workers. He's really kind of a wonderful model for the kind of person you want to be running a business.
Yeah, he was a super interesting character. I had maybe heard of the department store before, Jordan Marsh Department Store out of Boston, but didn't really know the backstory and how it was started by this guy, Evan Jordan, who was an orphan kid who shows up in Boston as a young, sort of mid-teenager, and learns the trade of, you know, sales and running a store, working for other people, and then eventually opens his own store, and it expands and grows and becomes one of the first, you know, departmentalized stores in America. And he was really, I think he was very influential on Bridget's career, such as it was, and then her decision to open her own grocery store. I think she learned things from working at Jordan Marsh and from her boss. And I argue in the book that it's even possible she borrowed money from him to open her own shop, because he was known to do that, either give or loan money to his employees to help them start their own businesses. So he was a super interesting guy and influential in the early days of the Kennedys.
Yeah. Bridget has these opportunities and she takes advantage of them, and she becomes a person who came here to be a servant, because that was about the only job open for unmarried Irish Catholic girls, and ends up being quite an incredible woman, raising four kids by herself, losing a child at the child's young age, and her only son that lived to adulthood was PJ. He becomes the one who is such a huge influence on his grandchildren.
Yeah, PJ's another great character, someone who I argue, you know, was also overlooked, as Bridget was. And the book is kind of divided into these two parts. Bridget's story encompasses the first half or so of the book, and then we pick up with PJ's story. And, you know, he's a poor American-born son of an Irish immigrant couple. His dad is dead. His mom is working all day and into the night at her grocery store, and he kind of roamed the streets and didn't have a great education and got in some trouble and spent some time at a house of detention, but in time kind of gets his act together and then gets into the saloon business. He started out as a longshoreman hauling cargo onto and off of ships in East Boston, working at the same docks where his father once worked. But then in time discovers sort of this affinity for being a saloon keeper, and buys one saloon and then another one, and in time has, you know, kind of a little mini empire for himself in Boston. And all of that work leads him into politics. You know, there's a very direct connection between, you know, the Irish immigrants or their children working in the liquor trades and then evolving into becoming politicians at a time when they were mostly kept out of politics in Boston and elsewhere. And PJ is part of this first wave of Irish Democratic politicians to start to take control and win elected office, and in time takes over the whole, basically the whole city of Boston. But during his day, he was outnumbered by far by old school Boston politicians, mainly Republicans.
It's really fascinating to think about the huge number of Irish Catholics who ended up in Boston. Their kids stayed there. And so over time, it came to take on the character with which we associate Boston now as being an Irish Catholic town. But it was not that way to begin with. They were not welcome. Very well known and one might think knowledgeable people, nonetheless, did not like them. Henry David Thoreau, Lyman Beecher, and of course Samuel Morse, already mentioned, thought it was a terrible thing that these people were coming to town and staying. But here we have a generation and a generation and a half later, and they become the movers and shakers of a new Boston.
Yeah, and that's what I really admire about the stories of these early Kennedys, Bridget and her son PJ, is that they face down all this antagonism and discrimination and hatred, and they just stuck to it and worked hard and moved their way up little by little. And ultimately, this is, to me, a story story about the transformation of a class of people who started with very little and moved their way up and, you know, achieved kind of the American dream for themselves. It's really a story about immigrant success in America. Mm-hmm. And other things too, the transformation of the city of Boston, as you said, becoming more of an Irish and Catholic city in just a few short decades, and PJ and his mother and his siblings kind of represent that transformation, and in fact we're at the forefront of it. So it's very much an immigrant success story in ways that we don't typically think of the Kennedys as being poor immigrants who had to work hard and face down these forces that were aligned against them.
That's what makes the story of PJ. This is Joseph Kennedy's dad. There's something that I thought was very interesting, that the Columbia Trust Company, which becomes part of PJ's life, and his son Joe's as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, if you read stories about Joe or hear sort of cursory summaries of his life, he's described as the youngest bank president in America because he took over the Columbia Trust Company in, I think, 1914. Well, it was his father's bank, started by Daddy and some of Daddy's friends years earlier. And, his father helped him get a job at Columbia Trust Company and really helped him start his own career in banking and in finance. But it really wouldn't have happened without PJ. Joe was born a wealthy kid. He was born to parents who had the means to send him to Harvard and give him the boost in life that propelled him to, these positions of high power and wealth and everything else we think of as the Kennedys.
And how typical, too, because PJ was not a guy who had a lot of educational opportunities. There were the public schools were aggressively Protestant. And even though they were Christian, they used the Protestant Bible, the King James. They used the Protestant version of the Ten Commandments, and there is a slight difference, and so forth, and made the Catholics feel as unwelcome as possible, which is one of the things that led to the rise in parochial schools across America for Catholic kids, which, ironically enough, in the state of Alabama, the rise of parochial schools had such disparate people as African Americans and, amazingly, the Klan in North Alabama in the 1920s, insisting that there needed to be a public-funded education for Protestant children because the Catholics were getting a great education in their parochial schools.
That's interesting. Wow.
Yeah. It is a fascinating thing, this history. So when John F. Kennedy, the president, goes back to Ireland to see County Wexford, his ancestral homeland, and is welcomed with great acclaim. This was vindication that the Irish were not shiftless and foolish and stupid and all the other things they were accused of being, that one of their own came to be president of the greatest country in the world. And he wrote a book called A Nation of Immigrants about it. His embracing of his heritage, do you think that gave him more of an appreciation for the immigrant experience and for the people that came to the United States while he was president and the people who were trying to come here?
Yeah, I think I developed an even deeper appreciation for John F. Kennedy's recognition of the importance of the immigrant to America. I had a general sense of the fact, as you said, that he wrote that book, which is published after his death, Nation of Immigrants, that was really, like a PSA for the immigrant experience. Mm-hmm. Like, not just the Irish, but every other immigrant class that makes this country, I think, strong and great. Yeah. And so I think he was a great champion of a country that supported immigrants from other countries and gives them the opportunities that they need to succeed, just like his family did. And I think that trip to Ireland, as you said, 1963, just a few months before he was killed, says a lot about his appreciation for where he came and his own heritage and the striving of his ancestors. I do find it interesting, though, that when he gave a speech at New Ross, the town up the street from his father's family farm, he gave a shout out to his great-grandfather, the cooper, the barrel maker, Patrick, but didn't mention Bridget, who was really the one who kept that family going after Patrick died. So You know, it's a fascinating story, and I think some pieces of it have been buried or forgotten or lost over time. So hopefully this reminds us a little bit about not just the Kennedys' immigrant background, but, you know, the power of all immigrants and what they're capable of.
Absolutely. Neil Thompson, the author of The First Kennedys, The Humble Roots of an American Dynasty. It's from Mariner Books, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers, and available everywhere. Also, as an e-book and audiobook. And you can go to their website. Neil, what's your website?
Yep, mine is my name. It's neilthompson.com, N-E-A-L, and folks can find information about this book and my other books. There are links there to buy this book from different resources, local independent bookstores, as well as Amazon, and other links on places that I'll be visiting to talk about the book and reviews and that kind of thing. And they can follow me on the social media stuff, too,
okay,
by going to neilthompson.com.
Excellent. Thank you, Neil. It's a very, very interesting book, not just about the Kennedys, but also about the whole Irish immigrant situation, about the whole story. And you've done a marvelous job and made these people come alive to us, and their hopes, their fears, their losses, their dreams, their triumphs and their losses. It's a great story, and I thank you so much for making time to talk to me about it today on the bookshelf.
I really enjoyed it, Doc. Thanks for having me on the show.
A book about the Irish immigrant experience, and perhaps it is in a larger sense about the immigrant experience in America and how unique it is. Neil Thompson, The First Kennedys, The Humble Roots of American Dynasty. It's from Mariner Books. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and on my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.